Welcome back to Baptist Basics University. This is the course on the Gospel of John, lesson number 36 in that series. The death and burial of Christ will be in John chapter 19, verses 19 through 42. Once again, I'm Matthew Gage. I appreciate you listening. This is also the first recording I have done since being able to add the podcast feed for these lessons to iTunes. So if you happen to be stumbling across these, you can hop in iTunes, search for Baptist Basics University, or you can search for Matthew Gage anyway. But we're now listed in iTunes, so that's a big step. But be able to reach a few more people, get a bigger audience. You can also subscribe to a podcast feed straight from the Baptist Basics University page, which is at baptistbasics.org/BBU. So you can go there and subscribe, click on the courses page. But just a number of exciting things, just being able to help get the word out about what I've been doing at baptistbasics.org, and just be able to reach a few more people, help some more people out. Well, we've come a long ways in our study of John. We're wrapping things up. Just three more lessons left, counting this one. And we've really now reached the climax of Christ's earthly ministry. Everything in Christ's ministry and his life, the very purpose for it all, is his come. And it's come and it's climaxing at the cross. The apex of his ministry is the cross. Everything has been headed this way. And so we finally reached this point. His countrymen, I guess you could say, the Jews, have rejected him. The leaders have passed him off, passed the death sentence. The Romans have passed the death sentence. And now the Roman soldiers are about to execute the King of Kings, the Lord of Lords, the God, creator of the universe, is about to be executed just outside of Jerusalem. Now, none of this is by accident. It's all according to the purpose and plan of God, as seen through the many, many prophecies in the Old Testament, as seen in the vital importance in the mission, that is, the salvation of man, and also as seen as emphasis of the cross in the early Christian writings. Look how many times the cross and Christ's death and his shed blood are spoken about in Paul's epistles. So now let's jump in to this, let's say, the darkest of dark times in human history, perhaps in the history of the universe. But yet it's not really all that dark when you think about it, because it's as sad and tragic as it seems that Christ is about to give his life, it is actually a victory. It is his victory over death, hell, and the grave. It is his, the spoils of that victory is the salvation of man. So let's look at the setting. These events take place on Wednesday, the 14th of Nisan, according to the Jewish calendar. I do not believe it was Friday. I think we've spoken about that before. It was on Wednesday. That's the only way you can calculate out for him being in the grave 3 days and three nights, as he said. He talked about it being the sign of Jonah. So 3 days and three nights. We know he was risen before Sunday morning. So to make it all fit, it has to be on Wednesday, with the Passover taking place on Thursday. The time we're going to cover is most of the daylight hours of Wednesday. It's somewhere around 9 o'clock in the morning that Christ was crucified. And the major events are going to take place just outside Jerusalem at a hill called Golgotha, the place of the skull. And I wish we knew exactly which hill this was. There's a couple of different sites that claim to be the correct one. I do like the evidence for Gordon's Calvary, which is kind of the more traditional Protestant site. The Catholics have another site they claim to be. We're not really sure. We know that it was outside the city walls. We know that it was near a road. It was on a hill. And so there's a lot of different factors. It could be a number of different places. But Gordon's Cavalry is as good a site as any. So we're going to jump right on in. I'm using a backup Bible for this lesson. So not one I'm used to reading. So if I stumble, a little bit different print in this one that I'm used to reading. So we'll jump right in here. The first thing we're going to deal with is the crucifixion of Christ. We'll begin in verse number 19. And Pilate wrote a title and put it on the cross. And the writing was, Jesus of Nazareth, the King of the Jews. Now, in ancient times, in Greek and Roman culture and society, when a criminal was condemned, they would have a piece of parchment or paper and write the charges on it. And I've heard that, like in with ancient Greeks, when they put the man in prison, they would actually attach this bill to the door, and when they were released, they would write paid in full on it and give it to him as evidence that he had paid his time and paid his dues to society. And that similarly, what's happened here is Jesus is going to be crucified, and this is the official charge. This is why he is being crucified, and it's going to be attached above him on the cross so that all can see what the charges were, why this man was being put to death. And the charges were that he was a king of the Jews, that he was attempting to overthrow the Roman government. According to Rome, that was the official charge. Now, the Jews, of course, it was for blasphemy, but for the Romans, who could care less what the religious beliefs of the Jews were, it was for treason. So, now, of course, Jesus was not trying to overthrow the Roman government, but he was the King of Kings, and the world was his and is his. And he will set up a kingdom. It was not the time. But, you know, you think about it in this sense, and maybe I can articulate this. But mankind rejected Christ because they wanted their own way. They wanted their own system. The Jews wanted their religion and their political power that they had. The Romans wanted to maintain their power. And they rejected and crucified Christ because they would not give up their way. And that's what we do too. We look in the face of God and say, not your will, but mine. That's, I wish I could quote it. This is kind of a new little vein of thought here for me. I just have, but I heard Adrian Rogers, who I believe is one of the greatest preachers in the past 100 or so years. If you get a chance, honestly, every time he preaches, it is a object lesson in proper homiletics. An amazing and powerful preacher that's gone on to be with the Lord. But I heard him talking about this, and he said, you know, that Christ prayed to the Father, said, not my will, but thine be done. And as a Christian, when we're saved, that's what we say to God, is that it's no longer my hopes and my strengths and my works to get me to heaven, but we're trusting fully on the works of God. But when somebody rejects Christ, that's what they're saying, is looking up to him and saying, not your will, but mine be done. And then he very powerfully puts it that at the judgment seat of Christ, or at the judgment seat, when the souls are finally cast into the lake of fire, that God will look down and say, not my will. My will was that you would be saved, but your will, because you rejected me, be done. Not my will, but thine be done. Very powerful. I don't remember the exact sermon I heard him preach that in, but very powerful. So anyway, so Pilate has written this charge. This is going to be affixed to the cross. Verse 20, this title then read many of the Jews, for the place where Jesus was crucified was nigh to the city, and it was written in Hebrew, Greek, and Latin. Now, why was it written in Hebrew and Greek and Latin? Just so everyone could read it. Hebrew, of course, the local tongue, so the locals could read it. Greek was the kind of the business language. It was the most widespread language. Thank you, Alexander the Great, and the Hellenistic society. So most people could speak Greek at least as a second language, the particular Koine form of Greek. And Latin, which was, of course, the official Roman, or the official language of Rome. So anybody that was there could pick up and read, if they could read, one of those three. I doubt there would be anybody in the territory that could read that could not read one of those three. Verse 21, then said the chief priest of the Jews to Pilate, write not the king of the Jews, but that he said, I am the king of the Jews. So the chief priests, they are balking at the writing. They don't like it because it seems to be that Pilate is saying that he was the king of the Jews. And they're saying, no, he was not our king. Just say that he claimed to be king because we don't want no part of him. Verse 22, Pilate's response. Pilate answered, what I have written, I have written. So Pilate says, look, I did it. I'm done with this. Let's just get it over with. So verse 23, we begin with the crucifixion. Then the soldiers, when they had crucified Jesus, took his garments, made four parts to every soldier a part, and also his coat. Now the coat was without seam, woven from top throughout. Let's see here. Let's go ahead and read verse 24. They said therefore among themselves, let us not rend it, but cast lots for it, whose it shall be, that the scripture might be fulfilled, which saith, they parted my raiment among them, and for my vesture they cast lots. These things, therefore, the soldiers did. And by the way, let's see, that prophecy would be Psalm 22, verse 18, is where that prophecy comes from there in verse 24. So the soldiers have now taken Christ. Of course, they've already beat and mocked him, and now they have led him out to Calvary. And once there, basically the possessions on the person of the condemned become property of the executioners. And so they get his clothes and they're going to gamble it away. Now, it talks about how took his garments and they ripped, there's four soldiers, and they just ripped his one garment because it just nothing special and they didn't want to fight over it. So they just ripped it up and basically made rags out of it. They just ripped his garment in four parts. Every man took his part. But talks about how his coat. Now, the clothing at the time, of course, there was an undergarment and then an outer garment that they wore. And so I believe this, I may be confused on this, but I believe this is the outer garment that it's talking about. And it evidently was very nice. It must have been a gift from someone to Christ, but it was a very nice, high-quality garment. And they said, we're not just ripping that up. We're going to save that. So it says they cast lot. Now, the casting of lots, do we know exactly what they were doing? Probably not. But archaeologists have dug up many, many times. In fact, you'll find them on the collectibles market. Little dice made out of bone that most people say all the soldiers use mainly because of this passage, and we know that they gambled quite a bit. So it probably was some type of dice, you know, maybe just whoever rolled the highest dice, you know, they got to keep it. So but anyway, that's what happens here. They gamble it away. Now, as to who these soldiers were, let's stop there, little historical sidelight here. The soldiers here, they're crucifying Christ, most likely are not of Roman blood. They are not Latin speaking. They are probably Syrian from what I've read. And because by this time on the frontiers, most of the legions were made up of foreigners. They were made up of people there on the outskirts of the empire. It was a chance for them to make some money, good employment. You know, you got 3 square meals a day, or I guess, I don't know how many meals they had, but, you know, it was just good employment, you know, good chance for you to make some money. And by this time, most of the Romans didn't want any part of it. They were either fat and rich or on the public dole and too lazy to join the legion. So a lot of the commanders would be Roman blood, but these men carrying this out very likely were not. Now, we don't know. There's no evidence of it. It's just basically speculation from, you know, just historical evidence. But evidently, these people were not Roman. They were not Jewish either. So they probably were from like Syria, maybe Egypt, some territory there in the area. And let's see, verse 25. So really what's happened here, there's a lot of this that's going on and was kind of skipped over. But Jesus, of course, is crucified. He's on the cross by this time. John kind of just goes over it very quickly, like in verse 17 and 18. And I think I kind of skimmed over those verses very quickly in the previous lesson. But crucifixion was a very, very nasty form of execution. It was, there's a lot of psychological implication to it. And I think I spoke some on that. But basically, yes, they would put you up and nail you to boards in the shape of a cross, like we were all familiar with. There are times that they would sometimes nail you to a beam and lift you up, and your feet would be loose or nailed, or that beam would be put into a tree and your feet would be nailed to the tree. There's times they would just nail you into a tree. And there are some people that claim that Christ was not crucified on a cross like we see, that perhaps he was actually nailed to a tree itself because wood was very scarce. I've heard that. I don't know about that. Some say that he was, you know, nailed to a beam and then that was tied up into a tree. That's possible. I really don't see any reason to doubt that Christ was crucified as we see depicted in so much iconography of him nailed on the cross, you know, with a vertical and a horizontal beam. I don't see any evidence to believe that he was not crucified in that manner. There were times that the cross would resemble the shape of an X, but as I said, I see no reason to doubt the traditional view on that. There are some people that just want to undermine everything traditional, and I think that's where a lot of the other debate comes from. So, verse number 25. Now there stood by the cross of Jesus his mother and his mother's sister Mary, the wife of Cleophas, and Mary Magdalene. So we got a bunch of Marys right here. Mary the mother of Christ, Mary the wife of Cleophas, and Mary Magdalene. So, very confusing. So, if you'd shout out, "Hey, Mary, how are you?" You'd have three people turn around and look at you. See, it really is amazing. Something worth studying out is how the role of women in the ministry of Christ. Some of his most faithful followers were women, and we see figures like Mary Magdalene quite a bit in the narrative, and even his mother pops up quite a bit. So, it's not uncommon that the women should be there. And it's not uncommon that them to be close. In fact, it really is a stark testimony of their faith and their relationship to Christ that the disciples, for the most part, are nowhere to be found, yet the women are there close. Verse number 26. When Jesus therefore saw his mother and the disciple standing by whom he loved, that is, we believe, John, he saith unto his mother, "Woman, behold thy son." Verse 27, then saith he to the disciple, "Behold thy mother." And from that hour, that disciple took her unto his own home. Jesus was the eldest son of Mary. Therefore, it was his responsibility to care for his mother in her old age. So evidently, Joseph has passed on. This, the traditional view is that Joseph has passed away, that he was very likely quite a bit older than Mary. So he has passed away. Mary right now is probably around 50 years old, give or take some. I mean, which is actually pretty good for ancient times. If you live past 30, you were beating the average. So she's probably around 50 years old. And at that time, you're getting well on up in years. I mean, it was very rare for people to live that old anywhere in the Roman Empire. And so he gives the earthly care of her to John, and says that John took care of her for the rest of her life there. Now, one little thing I want to point out, it's going to pop up in the next lesson. At the end of verse 26, he says, "Woman, behold thy son." Now, in the English, it sounds like that's very demeaning and scolding. "Woman!" You know, you picture the guy in his wife beater t-shirt, you know, "Woman, why don't you, where's my food? My supper's cold." you get that kind of picture there, but that's not what he's saying in the ancient languages. That's actually a very nice and polite way, I mean, like he was saying madam. So don't take anything into that. It's just kind of the respectful nature of that is kind of lost in translation. Verse 28, after this, Jesus, knowing that all things were now accomplished, that the scripture might be fulfilled, saith, I thirst. Now, Christ said seven things on the cross, and this is the only one that was a request, and it really was not honored. It was honored in a sense, but not truly. He said, I thirst, which would mean, hey, give me a drink, I'm thirsty. What would you think? Water. That would probably be what they'd give him. 29 says, now there was set a vessel full of vinegar, and they filled a sponge with vinegar and put it upon a hyssop and put it to his mouth. Now, the vinegar they're talking about was basically like a mild anesthetic. It was so it would dull the pain, and they would do this out of some mercy to the poor people that were being crucified. You know, you think if they really cared, they wouldn't crucify them, but they actually did, would give them some mild anesthetics. I guess they get a little tired of them yelling all the time. So that's basically what they were offering to him. When he said thirst, they gave him that, put on hyssop or on a sponge, and put on a pole and lifted up there to his mouth. Verse 30, when Jesus therefore had received the vinegar, he said, it is finished. And he bowed his head and gave up the ghost. Now, how did Christ die? Did the cross kill him? No. Did he die of a broken heart, like many people want to say? No. Christ gave his own life. He laid down his life. His life was not taken from him. It was not forced from him. He laid it down. He gave up the ghost. Now, that's very important to see, that he willingly laid down his life. Not just he laid down his life in the, to the cross and the cross killed him. No, he gave up his life of his own will. Verse number 31. The Jews, therefore, because it was the preparation that the body should not remain upon the cross on the Sabbath day, for that Sabbath day was an high day, besought Pilate that their legs might be broken and that they might be taken away. Now, it's going to be very important in what we're going to cover here through the end of the chapter to realize the timing of this. This is the day before Passover. This is the day of the preparation. At night, before nightfall, the Passover lamb is to be slain. There's a lot of preparation take place before the Passover would officially start at sundown. And there's a lot of Jewish customs that come into play with that. One thing is that a dead body was supposed to be buried by sundown, if at all possible. So what they're wanting to do is, of course, to get the bodies down off the cross, get this vile thing put away before the holy day, and also to get it buried before the holy day coming up. Now, it is referred to as the Sabbath there, but if you study out Jewish history and Jewish culture and Jewish religion, that does not necessarily mean that it was Saturday, that it was the Sabbath day. It was just the term for a holy day. There were these holy days, such as the Passover, were regarded as a Sabbath day, even though they did not necessarily fall on the seventh day of the week. They were still regarded as a Sabbath day, and the regulations regarding life on the Sabbath day were also in effect on these holy days. So the Jews have come to Pilate, and they're wanting to break the legs, which speeds up the process. Basically, from what I've heard, is that when on the cross, a person would have to push up with their legs and, on that nail through their ankles and push up to be able to get a good deep breath. Most people on the cross would last 24, 48, 72 hours, from some accounts even longer. And usually they would actually die of like starvation first or blood loss. It was not, a very quick. This was a very slow, torturous death. So what they're wanting to do is speed up process. So if they came by with a big club and broke their legs, they could no longer push up, which meant they would suffocate quicker and speed up process. So basically, they were wanting them dead and buried before sundown. So this is sometime during the middle afternoon. Verse 32, then came the soldiers and brake the legs of the first and of the other, which was crucified with him. But when they came to Jesus and saw that he was dead already, they brake not his legs. So they went ahead. The other two guys were alive. Jesus was dead. They brake their legs to speed up the death. But Jesus is already dead, so they do not break his legs, which is important. This was a fulfillment of prophecy, which we will get into that John points out here in a few verses. Verse 33. But when they came to Jesus and saw that he was dead already, verse 34. But one of the soldiers with a spear pierced his side, and forthwith came there out blood and water. Verse 35, and he that saw it bare record, and his record is true, and he knoweth what he saith true, that ye might believe. So, where am I at here? Let me make sure I'm getting ahead of myself. Yes, I am. Totally way off on my notes here. Let's look at verse 34. The soldiers came, they pierced his side, they stuck a Roman spear up underneath his ribs, up into his heart, and it talks about that blood and water came out. Now, did the spear kill him? No, he was already dead. And there's a lot of speculation on what the blood and the water mean. I think there are probably some spiritual applications that you can take from that. I don't think there is a lot that you can make out from a medical standpoint in that. Some people have tried, saying that, you know, his heart ruptured, he died of a broken heart. But I really think that you're grasping at straws there. Basically, the main thing was that Christ was dead, and they proved he was dead. Which also, by the way, the little swoon theory that comes out, that came out, that, oh, Jesus really didn't die. When they put him down in the tomb, he was still alive, and the cold air of the tomb made him come back to life. If you had been stuck with a Roman spear, do you really think after 3 days you would be alive? Probably not. Especially, I mean, there would be no care, because he was dead. It's not going to hurt him. I'm sure they stuck a spear up in him good. This was not a superficial wound. So I kind of got ahead of myself here. Let's read verses 35 through 36. We'll see the fulfilled prophecy here. And he that saw it bear record, and his record is true, and he knoweth that he saith true, that ye might believe. Common thing here in the book of John, that ye might believe. Verse 36, for these things were done, that the scriptures should be fulfilled, a bone of him shall not be broken. Now that is a quote from Psalm 34:20. You can also look up Exodus 12:46 and Numbers 9:12. Those are also in the marginal references here in my Bible. And verse 37, and again another scripture says, they shall look on him whom they have pierced. And that is from Zechariah 12:10. So basically we see that these fulfilled prophecies, just minutia is fulfilled in the crucifixion. Now, there's so much from the prophecy that curses him that hangeth upon a tree. I didn't quote that exactly right. We know that was there. We know that, you know, his own received him not, and that his own people reject him. We know that he laid down his life of his own will. There's so much about the crucifixion that was prophesied hundreds of years before. And here John takes the time to point out two more. And the one, that a bone of him should not be broken, which is important when you look at the idea of him being a sacrifice. The sacrificial animals under the law of Moses had to be perfect. They could not have a broken bone. So they had to be perfect, had to be whole. And Christ was physically perfect and whole, of course, but also in a spiritual sense. So it kind of harkens back to the typology of the Old Testament. In verse 37, a very vivid imagery created here says, they shall look upon him whom they have pierced. Well, it was very, he had to be pierced, which, of course, would point to the nails in his hands, would point to the spear being stuck in him, that he couldn't be stoned, he couldn't be hung, he couldn't have his head chopped off. He had to be pierced in his death. And there had to be a crowd of people watching to fulfill that. So they look upon him whom they have pierced, talking about specifically the crucifixion. So now we come to a division here. In the next, the next five verses here at the end of the chapter deal with the burial. So Christ is now dead. The work of the cross is done. It's over. He's cried out, it's finished. And by the way, I forgot to mention in verse 30, which says it is finished. It's not just, oh, it's over, I'm done. That's the cry of a victor. It's the cry of victory, saying it is finished, I have won. So I'm going to throw that in. I forgot to mention that. So now he is dead. It's the late afternoon, middle afternoon hours. So by Jewish tradition, he needs to be buried and needs to be buried quickly. Now, most people that were executed, by what I've read, would just be thrown into a common grave, perhaps even just into the trash heaps. They had little regard for their bodies. But Christ's case was different. It's going to be very important that they know he's buried. It's going to be very important that they know he has risen. So he's going to be buried. The tomb is going to be sealed. And it's going to be obvious that he was there, and then he wasn't. Verse 38. Now after this, Joseph of Arimathea, being a disciple of Jesus, but secretly for fear of the Jews, besought Pilate that he might take away the body of Jesus. And Pilate gave him leave. He came there, therefore, and took the body of Jesus. So Joseph Arimathea, this is really, I believe, the only appearance by this man. Probably a member of the Sanhedrin, very wealthy, very influential. He comes to Pilate and says, look, I would like the body of the guy you just executed. And I'm sure Pilate says, well, why would you want that? But if you want it, you can have him. You know, big deal. I'm just glad it's over with. So he gives Joseph the power to take the body. Now, it's interesting that none of the disciples asked for it. His own family didn't ask for it, but Joseph of Arimathea was the only one bold enough to go before Pilate and claim the body. Verse 39, and there came also Nicodemus. Nicodemus, remember him, very famous guy, John chapter 3, the same Nicodemus, which at first came to Jesus by night, of course, referencing back to John chapter 3, and brought a mixture of myrrh and aloes, about 100-pound weight. So Nicodemus also comes. So Joseph went and got the body. Nicodemus has come with the stuff to help prepare the body. Now, the Jews would prepare the body kind of like a mummy is a very easy way to describe it. They would, not that they would remove the brain and stuff like the Egyptians did, but they would wrap it up in a similar fashion. They would put these spices and stuff on the body and in the wrap just to kind of keep it smelling good. Especially in a case like this where the burial was very hurried and they wanted to make sure when they came back a few days later to really do it right, that it didn't stink too bad and the body was kind of preserved during that time. Because, I mean, of course, the embalming and stuff just was not around, was not a practical science by any stretch. So that's what Nicodemus has brought. It says about 100-pound weight. Now, by the ancient Roman weight, converting that to modern weight, that actually turns out to be somewhere around 70 pounds. Now, I'm not correcting the Bible. It says 100 pounds. Yes, it says 100 pounds, but you've got to convert from the ancient Roman pound to the modern pound. And actually, the word there is libra, I believe it is what the Romans called it. So, and it's about a 70%, our pound's about 70% the size. So, about 70 pounds, which is also interesting. Because tradition says that, Jewish tradition said that when burying, you were supposed to use half the body weight in these spices to prepare the body. So if they got 70 pounds of spices, that meant Jesus probably weighed about 140 pounds, which at that time probably was about an average-sized man. It sounds pretty light nowadays, but back then, people were smaller. I mean, most people, from what I've read, 5 foot, 5 foot six. They were very short people. It's really not until the last 150 years that 6 foot has really taken off as an average. So he was just an average size man. Verse 40. Then took they the body of Jesus and wound it in linen clothes with the spices, as the manner of the Jews is to bury. So they would wrap up the body, the fingers individually, then the hand. And as they're wrapping it, they would put these spices inside the wraps, these all these different things that they would do. Verse 41, now in the place where he was crucified, there was a garden, and in the garden a new sepulcher, wherein was never man yet laid. Now this tomb, we find out elsewhere, belonged to Joseph of Arimathea. So this was his own personal tomb, a brand new tomb. This was actually very expensive. Only the rich and powerful had tombs like this and could afford to even have these things carved out. Many times they would just place the bodies in caves. They would even bury them, even as we do nowadays. They would even reuse tombs. They would go in and, you know, kind of sweep up the remains, put them in little boxes, and, you know, reuse the tombs. So it's very amazing that this is a brand new tomb, nobody's used, and that Christ's body is laid in there. It's very amazing that Joseph would even give it up. But shows his love for Christ, and also may just show that it was that time was growing short. They need to get him buried, and they can get him buried now, and it was there and available. Verse 42, there laid they Jesus, therefore, because of the Jews' preparation day, for the sepulcher was nigh at hand. So, once again, the day of preparation, that's the 14th of Nisan, the day before the Passover, which, because they, this is called the day of preparation, because there were certain things they had to do to prepare for the Passover, including the killing of the Passover lamb. That took place not on the 15th, but on the 14th of Nisan. So, as the sun's going down, it's getting late in the day, they're hurrying, trying to get this done. The tomb is there, it's available, it's ready, so that's where they place the body of Christ. Now, there is a place that is claimed to be this tomb, the Garden Tomb in Jerusalem. And is it the one? It could be. I don't know for certain. There's evidence that points towards it. There's evidence also I've seen that points against it. But it really doesn't matter that we know exactly the tomb. There's thousands of tombs there in that area. What is important is that the tomb did not stay populated. That 3 days and three nights from now, on the first day of the week, on Sunday morning, they're going to go to the tomb, the stone's rolled away, and there is not a body. The grave clothes are laying there, but there's not a body. Jesus had risen. That is the most important thing. So now we will leave it there. And in the next lesson, we will actually cover all of John chapter 20. And we will cover the resurrection of Christ. And look forward to having you join me there. Now, before I close this one, I realize I have not been very good in giving contact information for these lessons, especially for those who may be getting this through iTunes. Once again, my name is Matthew Gage. My website is baptistbasics.org. You can reach me through email at webmaster@baptistbasics.org. That's the main point of contact for my website. Now, if you email me there and it's honest and legit, and you're not trying to pick a fight or something or ridicule me, I do try to email most people back. So you can reach me there. You can actually find this series of lessons and the other series of lessons that are available. I think I've got four complete series. I've got John, one on Children's Church, one on the bus ministry, and Baptist history. So you can take advantage of those if you will just go to baptistbasics.org/BBU. And as I'm always trying to find new ways of getting this material out, of course, you can now find this on iTunes. Just search for Baptist Basics University. I also have an RSS feed that you can subscribe to keep up with news. You'll find that if you go to the homepage at the website. There's also a Facebook page where you can become a fan of BaptistBasics.org. I'm debating whether or not to keep that up, just for popularity reasons mainly, but you can become a fan of the website and ministry there. So just a number of ways you can kind of keep up with the website. I hope to be able to expand it quite a bit, especially with these lessons. I've really enjoyed doing these lessons on the Gospel of John, and I'm hopefully get back in the swing of things and be able to produce some more lessons like this. Well, I hope it's been a help and a blessing to you, and I will see you in the next lesson, which I hope to have up very shortly, and hopefully have the entire lesson series wrapped up by the first week in June. So I thank you for listening. God bless you, and I'll see you next time.